I'm Redbeard from InTheStudio.net with a 21st century look at history's greatest rock bands.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
guitar three.
Today in the studio, the news is all bad because Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk, the original Bad Company,
records we listened to when we were getting turned on to music were actually 40 years old. You know, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Albert King and all these guys. We were listening to quite old music, but to us it was very, eternal music. I can still listen to it now.
Yes.
And groove. And I think we took something from that, and that's probably part of what we do.
Good, it keeps you on your toes. Nothing's set in stone, but as Paul says, we have a great collection of songs, fortunately for us, that people want to hear.
This is Simon Kirk of Bad Company.
This is Mick Ralphs of Bad Company on the In Studio program with Redbeard.
This is Paul Rodgers, also of Bad Company, on In the Studio with Redbeard. And here we are celebrating.
As we gaze through the spyglass of time in reverse, we see that it was September 1973, and there's a ruckus interrupting the tranquility of the cool English country evening air. It's coming from the rural home owned by Paul Rodgers, who, in only 4 years with the British band Free, had quickly established himself as a powerful, soulful singer of the highest caliber. His mate, Simon Kirk, from the now disbanded Free, was there bashing away on the drums crammed into the close quarters, and the thick power chords echoing in the night of the pastoral English setting came from the Les Paul guitar in the hands of Mick Ralphs, late of British band Mott the Hoople. That night, only in the wildest rock and roll fantasy could one imagine that exactly 1 year later, Rodgers, Ralphs, and Kirk would be playing those embryonic songs as Bad Company in front of 73,000 fans packed into the University of Texas football stadium in Austin. But that's precisely what happened. Setting Bad Company on a Hall of Fame-worthy path, I spoke to Bad Company guitarist co-founder Mick Ralphs, who answered first, followed in order by Bad Company singer co-founder Paul Rodgers, and then Bad Company drummer Simon Kirk.
We never anticipated. Well, you don't when you're young. You don't think about more than about a year ahead at the most. But fortunately for us, people still want to see us, and we still want to do it. So that's great.
I'm not that surprised that we're still doing something musically because, well, that was on the cards from day one, really. I think we're all very passionate about music.
Yeah.
The music we listened to and the music we were actually playing ourselves. And so I would have thought that, 40 years down the road, we would be doing something. And I'm actually surprised myself at how fresh it sounds when we come back together and we're playing these old songs.
They still sound good. Yeah.
But there's still a lot of life in them, really a lot of life.
Absolutely.
And I think, to me, if I could say it, the records we listened to when we were getting turned on to music were actually 40 years old. You know, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Albert King and all these guys. We were listening to quite old music, but to us it was very, eternal music. I can still listen to it now.
Yes.
And groove. And I think we took something from that, and that's probably part of what we do.
Well, yes, because music of that caliber doesn't date, doesn't go out of, you know, it doesn't sound.
Yeah.
The recording techniques have changed, but the actual grooves.
Absolutely.
I guess we're
the old blues men of the 2010s.
Well, yeah. We've taken that thing on.
We have. Did you get that, Redbeard?
Yeah,
I tell you what, though, you know, it's funny. I agree with what Paul said that. Whenever we got back together, you know, we only actually toured properly about 2 years ago, and it's like we were never away.
Well,
it's amazing.
To jump in there, I think Simon's right there. Well, there is, and it's interesting. You know, there's so many songs, as you say. There's so many songs in the catalogue that we actually have to play.
Yeah,
that the set, I mean, it's just a matter of rearranging the songs into a different order and creating a different show each time we go out.
Yeah.
And what happens is you put a set list together and we kick off with that, and then that's going to develop through the shows as we go on. So each gig is unique, and each tour is unique too.
Yeah, because the set sort of changes as we go along, doesn't it? We'll say, well, let's try that one there tomorrow. Yeah. And it's good. It keeps you on your toes. Nothing's set in stone. But we have, as Paul says, we have a great collection of songs, fortunately for us, that people want to hear.
Public proof that a Bad Company 40th anniversary tour was imminent came with their impressive live performance of their signature theme song on the popular Tonight Show with Jay Leno, which made me wonder, wait a minute, Had Bad Company, one of the biggest bands of the 70s, ever appeared on American network TV before? Simon Kirk answers first with Mick Ralphs, then Paul Rodgers chimes in.
Yeah, we did Don Kirshner's rock concert, I think twice.
We did two different shows. We did the in
concert. With ABBA. Believe it or not, it was with ABBA.
Was it?
They just had Waterloo. And I remember watching from the side of the stage Swedish girls in their leather pants. It was rather nice.
Don't look so clever now, though, I can tell
but
you.
No, they don't look so clever now. But but that was...
Sorry, girls. I don't mean it.
I think those were the only two shows, Redbeard, that Bad Company played. I might be wrong.
There was two. There was one called In Concert, and then the other was called Don Kirshner's Rock Concert.
Yeah.
Because the one Keith Mooney introduced us on, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it was a whole chore we played, didn't we?
Yeah, we came running on, remember?
Yeah.
Huh. And you had the Wurlitzer in those days.
That's right, yeah.
But the Tonight Show, it was the first time we played in a year together.
And I must say the sound they got for us was fantastic.
Boy.
You know, Sandy and Charles there, they did
a great job.
Sam was really inspiring. We just were able to really
Yeah, because we've never done those type of, those late night chat show things, if you want to call them that. But it's become more and more, in England as well, they feature a lot more rock bands on those sort of shows now than they used to. Mm. They were really geared up to a rock band. There was no, like, can you turn it down, boys, and we just play your thing, and it was great sound.
We've done British TV. Oh, yeah, I mean, hey, you know, but all the camera crew walked off because it was too loud.
It was like it was the school,
almost
really.
Acoustic. And we were like, where's everybody gone? You know? and it was a it was kind of square in those days. I mean, I think it might be a little bit different now.
But, yeah, it's a little bit better, but it was very rinky-dink, wasn't it, in those days? Poor old Bob Harris.
Well, Bob Harris, that was a good show, though. Did you do that many times? Yeah.
He's a good lad. Yeah, he was. But Whistle Test.
It was run
on a shoestring budget, and they had the cameraman from the gardening programmes. This old guy's about 80, just wanted to go home. Didn't want to hear anything noisy at all. I think G pulled us in the end. Peter Grant said,
no, come on, boys.
He said, it's not. It doesn't sound like
If you can't
company.
Play properly, then we'll
it sound
you know,
like a
we'll
folk group.
He kept saying, can you please turn it down a little more? And it was Feel Like Making Love, so the verses were
actually
okay.
Loud. Just, oh, yeah, I guess,
you know,
yeah.
The verses were okay because it's, you know... But chorus, then we hit the
chorus kicked
and
in.
Suddenly
and
the cameras just went limp.
Yeah.
And they just sort of left, you know, dangling and
it's very old fashioned the BBC, well it was in Wankers. Those days.
Bless them. Yeah. We probably shouldn't say too much because we might want to do a TV show.
Oh yeah.
Down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Great. I love
them. Smashing.
Fabulous.
Lovely.
Walking down this rocky road, wondering where my life is leading, rolling on to the bitter end. Finding out along the way what it takes to keep love living. You should know how it feels, my friend. I want
the song Ready for Love is a Mick Rouse composition he brought with him from the Mötley Hoople days. Up next, you'll find out why the original Bad Company never released a live album, but how they're making up for it big time in a remarkable way every night. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Paul Rodgers, Mick Rouse, and Simon Kirk, living out a rock and roll fantasy.
This is Simon Kirk of Bad Company.
This is Mick Rouse of Bad Company on the in-studio program with Redbeard.
This is Paul Rodgers, also of Bad Company, on In the Studio with Redbeard.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Along with American TV's reappraisal, apparently there's been a rethink for Bad Company regarding making live performances available to their fans. Now think about it. Can you name one superstar arena-filling band in the 70s without a live album in their original catalog? Bad Company is recording every single concert and making it available to the audience literally on your way out the door each night. Filing out after a killer concert on your way to the parking lot, how many times have you or someone with you remarked, "Wow, I sure wish I could get a recording of that show we just saw"? Here's Simon Kirk.
Yeah, I think that when I'm on my way to the car, and then I wonder where the hell I left my car. You ever done that? Left an arena? Think, where the hell
yeah.
My car?
Well, back in the day, it wasn't such a thing that bands did, was it? There was people didn't sort of make DVDs and
no.
Put out like
live albums with a kiss of death in it.
Peter Frampton had a huge.
Radio wouldn't play them, would they?
That's right.
Except Frampton. Yeah. There's only Frampton who had a good one.
But it's as time went on, it tastes changed, and then we got into the digital age, and everybody was making videos and DVDs.
I think the quality has improved on live now as well.
Yeah.
You can actually, I mean, you know, you've got to capture a good show if you're going to do it. But Wembley was we got lucky because we'd planned to record that night. You never know if the night you're going to record is going to be a good night.
No, you can't predict that.
Do you think? Yeah. But it happened to be a great night.
Yes, yeah,
it really did.
Yeah.
I mean, I've said that before, actually. But it is true.
Yeah.
You know, we did, and we caught one.
But you're right, in the old days, it was all very hit and miss, recording bands live anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The technology wasn't there. You know, you're still fiddling around with cassette machines and, you know, it's much, much more organised these days, which makes for better sounding live albums, you know.
I gotta show tonight.
Actually, we're going to be releasing live on each show. It will be available after the show.
Yeah, which
so
is
that's,
great.
That's something that can be done nowadays, which is incredible.
Yeah, we're recording each show, Redbeard, and people can buy it at the end of the show.
That's great. Yes, it's amazing. Get it on the night.
I think it's a better souvenir than a T-shirt, which is usually $40, and it wears out after three wears. And here you get a DVD, you know, or a CD for, I don't know, $12-15. You know,
it's a nice memento.
It's a better memento, I think.
It is. Yeah.
A crappy T-shirt.
Right. As a sidebar, it's important to note that between Bad Company's 30th and 40th reunions, Paul Rodgers accepted a challenge that on paper looked impossible, even for his legendary voice, that being two world tours and an album with arguably the most popular band in the world, Queen, singing in tribute to the late Queen vocalist Freddie Mercury. I asked Paul Rodgers of Bad Company what he brought back to his band.
Well, it was an incredible experience. I mean, because he had a 50-foot thrust that went right out, or 50 yards or something. It was a really long thrust that went right out deep into the audience. And you're looking at about, 50,000, 60,000 people in somewhere like, where was it?
Sarajevo.
Kiev.
Yeah, Sarajevo. Yeah. All these Eastern European places that we've never played before.
That's
and it was,
right.
It was quite amazing to, rock you. It was just amazing to be at the centre of that, you know.
Yeah.
And they played our songs well too. I mean, they did Feel Like Making Love. We did Bad Company. I mean, I used to. we arranged to have the piano come up through the stage.
Oh wow!
In smoke, and I would start to play before I appeared on stage in smoke.
Wow!
And a couple of things happened there. A couple of Spinal Tap occurred. There were some Spinal Tap moments, I have to say, but it was it was very theatrical, and one took part in that. You know, lots of big stage, a lot of running around. Well, the fans absolutely loved the songs. We were in Italy, and we played. I think it was "I Want to Break Free," and the audience actually took the song. I let them take the song, and they sang it, and they knew the words and every breath that Freddie had taken on the record better than I did. Wow. So, I want to break free. Breath. I want to, you know, I mean, they were like, I just was amazed. They were actually louder than the band. They drowned us out.
Wow.
So we couldn't hear the band. So it was pretty amazing. But they're a super, I mean, you know, I say this, they are a super commercial band. They're a super commercial entity, and I don't think they would deny that themselves. Where we are, though, I think we come from a different place. We definitely come from a different place. You know, the lyrics are simpler. There's more time. There's more space in the music, you know, for the audience to step in, and which they definitely do. And I think, you know, dare I say, I think we have... There's a lot more soul in what we do. And that's not to criticise anyone, but it's the difference between, you know, the way I see it.
I mean, speaking for me, you know, I saw Paul and Queen in Nassau Coliseum, and I was bowled over. I mean, number one, it was just great to hear him sing again. And I hadn't heard Paul sing
Simon.
For many, many, many years. And it was just great. And also, I love Brian May's guitar work. I think he's a fantastic player. And it worked with Paul. I think Paul and Brian worked really, really well together.
Well, I went to see Paul with Queen at Wembley in London. And like Simon, I thought it was amazing. The show was fantastic. I knew some of the guys, Roger and Brian, and some of the side guys. But to see Paul up there, you know, doing those, you know, I suppose, classic Queen songs, but with his own soulful take on it, I thought it was great that he did it like that.
Company. Destiny is a rising sun. Oh, I was born, six gun in my hand. Behind a gun, I make my final stand. Yeah. sisters we are called. Chose a gun and threw away the sword. Now these times six gun sound is our claim to fame. I can hear them say, bad company, and I won't deny. Bad, bad company till the day I die.
When we come back, Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk confess to being unprepared for instant stardom, particularly in America. The importance of their legendary manager then, Peter Grant of Led Zeppelin fame. Why there were cows about when Paul Rodgers sang on the actual recording of the song Bad Company? Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and many more interviews are found at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk of the original Bad Company.
This is Simon Kirk of Bad Company.
This is Mick Ralphs of Bad Company on the In the Studio program with Redbeard.
This is Paul Rodgers, also of Bad Company, on In the Studio with Redbeard.
In previous interviews here in the studio, each member of Bad Company admitted to being surprised by America's immediate anointing of the band as a supergroup upon release of their debut in spring 1974, but somewhat confounded by the lesser initial response at home. Since both Free and Motha Hoople had each been bigger in the UK, it would seem logical if the response to Bad Company's debut reversed. I wondered about the band's theories, and Paul Rodgers answered first.
Well, England is a different. England is very slow to take on a new entity and to accept you in a different form. Yeah. America embraced us as a new entity from the start, you know, and anything that had gone in the past was the past, you know. And that was, it was a surprise, and it was great for us because what we were doing was basically playing music that we loved. That was the priority. Do we like this song? Do we want to play this song? And it wasn't a question of will it sell, will it be played on the radio, or any of commercial anything like that. It was just do we want to play this? And we were very passionate, which we still are actually, about playing the music and where it takes us to, and taking the audience with us. Mm. And that was really our only consideration, and it still is. And amazingly, that seemed to click with America at that time. You know,
yeah, it did. I think it's because it was natural. It wasn't contrived. And we didn't, you know, as Paul said, we didn't think about it in a business sense or whatever. We just played what we wanted to play, what we liked to play, with a real conviction.
We were actually a genuine garage band,
yeah,
like, weren't we?
Yes, yeah. Without a garage.
Without a garage, yeah. In fact.
Well, but, it wasn't, there was no master plan of what I'm trying to say. It was all like lucky coincidences, and we hooked up with Peter Grant and all that stuff.
There's a mindset in England that almost resents success.
Oh, definitely.
And Zeppelin had it to a degree when they first started out, and they got very big in America very quickly.
What they had, they didn't have an attitude, but they had that attitude towards them.
Right, yeah, the British attitude. Yeah, it's almost like, well, you belong to us, and how dare you go over there and desert us. And to a degree, I think that could be levelled at us, that we did enjoy success very quickly in America. And we, because Free and Mott the Hoople in particular were so loved by
the Brits
in England, the fact that they'd broken up in order to form Bad Company, that's what people thought. Mm. There was a level of resentment towards us, to a degree.
But, yeah.
I mean, not
but, I mean,
always.
In a way, and I can't say I blame them, in a way, because they loved the band. I mean, they did. They loved
Jesus.
Free.
Yeah.
And so they did come round eventually, as we sort of showed it when we did Wembley and we recorded that last gig.
Yeah.
The crowd was just, England, you know, was just fantastic. So little slower coming round.
Yeah, they were quicker to accept us here, but they did. We did some good gigs in England and Europe over the years. I mean, they liked us, but maybe not quite so fervently as they do over here. But that's just English reserve, I think.
Yeah, somehow I think there was an American angle in our music, and it appealed
more than it did. Yeah, the sound of it and the blues influences, yeah.
Yeah, more than it did in England and Germany. And like
That's right.
I'm gonna
Company had the distinction of being the first band signed to Led Zeppelin's vanity label called Swan Song, and Bad Company also shared managers with Zeppelin. Bad Company guitarist songwriter Mick Ralphs explains just how vital the late manager Peter Grant was to Bad Company's initial success.
Well, he was extremely important. I remember Paul and I were down at Paul's little cottage in England, knocking names about, and we'd come up with a name for the band. And Simon had turned up from Brazil, I think, and me and Paul said, well, all we need is a bass player, and we've got a group, because we hadn't actually planned on having a band. We were just going to work on songs.
I thought we were making a band, but anyway, that's all right.
No, well, we did eventually.
Now you tell me.
Me and you just writing songs. Remember?
Well, we did, yes. Yeah.
And then Simon comes up, and I said, all we need is a bass. And then you said, oh, for a band, we've got to have a manager. We're going to have for as a manager. Yeah. And we said, who's the biggest group in the world? And you said Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And I said, right, who's his manager? We'll start at the top and work down.
Yeah.
And luckily, Paul knew a guy, Clive Coulson, who they'd worked with, who would work with Peter Grant. Peter Grant agreed to come and see us or listen to us before deciding to take us on.
I actually, on reflection, I think it was that Peter has said to Clive, go around and see what he's up to down there. Because three had split up.
And see
what they're doing and get him to call me. I think that's possibly what happened. Yeah, because Clive come around, he says, why don't you call Peter up? I'm like,
yeah, I remember him coming around to say,
I'm not going to call Peter Grant, he's the manager of Led Zeppelin. Yeah, no, call him up, it's okay, it's cool.
Yes.
Here's the number.
There you go.
So eventually I did, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think we realised at the time that Zeppelin were launching their own
label.
I mean, no, that was your coincidence. Then.
It was just Peter Grant and we just managers, thought, you know.
If he's interested, great. If he's not, then we'll try somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
Luckily, he decided to take us on and, he was very important.
Oh, they were awesome, actually.
You know, Zeppelin, he said, I'll kick down the doors, but it's up to you to play the music. He has that sort of approach.
Yeah.
He gave us the opportunity, but he made it very clear that you would only do it if we come up with the goods, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of...
And it was great because that's all we had to think about was the music.
Yeah.
Baby, when I think about you, I think about love. Darling, I don't live without you.
Company drummer, Simon Kirk.
And I believe we did it on a handshake. I don't think we signed.
We did. He said to me, because at first he was talking about managing and blah, 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 and he came around, saw the band and everything, and then we sat in his office, and I don't know if we were all sitting around or what, but he said to me, remember him saying, now, I don't know you, and you don't know me. We're not going to have any contracts. We're just going to do it on a handshake and see how we go. And I like took about a quarter of a second, and I thought, yep, that'll do me.
That's fine.
And
he was very fair with us, I must admit. He was very good.
If he was on your side, everything was great.
Very protective of his artists.
If you weren't, you're in deep doo-doo.
But it was, he did. He did. I think the Zeppelin connection also gave us a bit of added oomph, if you will. But at the end of the day, as he said, it's up to us to do it. He said, I can't make people like you. He said, you've got to go, go and do what you're doing, see what happens. So luckily, we were up to the, we rose to the
occasion.
The occasion.
Johnny was a schoolboy when he heard his first Beatles song. Love Me Do, I think it was, and from there it didn't take him long. Got himself a guitar, used to play every night. Now he's in a rock and roll outfit and everything's alright. Don't you know? Johnny told his mama, hey mama, I'm going away. I'm gonna hit the big time, gonna be a big star someday. Mama came to the door with a teardrop in her eye. Johnny said, don't cry, Mama, smile and wave goodbye. Don't you know? To number one. Suddenly everyone loved to hear him sing a song. Watching the world go by, surprising it goes so fast. Johnny looked around him and said, well, I made the big time at last. Don't you know? Don't you know? Don't you know that you are? Don't you know? Don't you know?
revealed to me that Shooting Star from the second Bad Company album, 1975 Straight Shooter, was inspired by the early deaths of Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Paul Rodgers, Mick Ralphs, and Simon Kirk. This has been written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2019, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.